From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Barry Jenkins and Steve McQueen's last films won Best Picture Oscars. Now their new movies are showing at the Toronto International Film Festival. Then musician Aaron Dessner helped create a streaming platform that uses people, not computers, to help make your music picks.
The algorithm, why can't I like a folk song and some, you know, experimental noise? You know, why do I only have to listen to folk songs that are similar to the folk song I just heard?
And we look at how movies and TV shows have shaped our ideas about the FBI. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's Science Fair. Called inspirational and invigorating by the LA Times, the documentary follows 9 high school students on their journey to change the world through science. ScienceFairFilm.com. Science Fair, in theaters starting September 21st.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. We're going to start today with a check-in at the Toronto International Film Festival and some of the movies that are generating some Oscar buzz north of the border. Kyle Buchanan, a good friend of the show and now the new carpetbagger columnist at the New York Times, is up in Canada catching all the movies that he can. And I asked him for his take on 2 movies from the directors of recent Best Picture Oscar winners, If Beale Street Could Talk by Barry Jenkins, who directed Moonlight, and Widows by Steve McQueen, who made 12 Years a Slave.
I love both of these movies. Widows is sort of the more conventional blockbuster, but it's not conventional because it's Steve McQueen who made 12 Years a Slave. He takes Viola Davis, Michelle Rodriguez. I mean, it's a truly stacked cast of wonderful actresses and actors. And it's about these 4 women who try to pull off a heist after most of their husbands, who are criminals, are killed.
My husband left me the plans for his next job. All I need is a crew to pull it off.
Why should we trust you anyway?
Because I'm the only one standing between you and a bullet in your head.
While that is sort of conventional in its outline, what McQueen is interested in or lingers on or packs as subtext into every single scene is so fascinating. You could take one scene from this movie at random and I'd have more to say about it than most full movies I've seen this year. It's a real full meal. And then there's If Beale Street Could Talk, adapted by Barry Jenkins, the director of Moonlight, from the novel by James Baldwin. It has this radiant unknown actress, Kiki Layne, as the lead. She plays a pregnant 19-year-old who's trying to exonerate her lover, who's been falsely accused of a crime in Harlem. And it is truly one of the prettiest, most beautiful, most lush films I've seen at Toronto or this year. Lush in color. Lush in feeling, love, romance, and thought.
When a lot of actors decide they're going to get behind the camera, sometimes they do a short, sometimes they do a little indie film. Bradley Cooper didn't follow that path. He has a movie called A Star is Born. It's, I don't know if we're calling it a remake or a reimagining or what you want to call it, but Star is Born with Bradley Cooper not only directing but also starring opposite Lady Gaga. It did not play in Telluride, but it did play in Toronto. How'd it go over?
I don't think it could have gone over better. This is a massive crowd pleaser in every sense of the word. It's massive in its scale and the way that it depicts these concerts, that superstar lifestyle, but it's also so intimate, so accessible, so well done in absolutely every respect.
I don't sing my own songs.
Why?
I just don't feel comfortable.
Why wouldn't you feel comfortable?
Almost every single person has told me they like the way I sounded, but that they didn't like the way I look.
I think you're beautiful.
It makes me kind of chuckle to myself, John, that the Academy had explored introducing this popular film Oscar this year, because this film, A Star is Born, is the very definition of a film that will be popular at the box office. It almost can't help but be. It's an incredible crowd-pleasing musical. But at the same time, it's so well done that it is a Best Picture, possible even front runner. I think that if we end up with a Best Picture race that has A Star is Born and Black Panther in it, you really couldn't have a better repudiation of the idea that what Oscar is interested in is by definition not popular.
So like the Cannes Film Festival, Telluride and other festivals have a pretty bad track record in movies directed by women. And over the past weekend, there was a rally in Toronto that was organized by female filmmakers, activists, and actors. And Cameron Bailey, who's the co-head of the Toronto Festival, signed an inclusivity pledge to try to get better gender parity in the festival's management. But did Toronto do any better this year in terms of films made by and featuring women?
Not staggeringly so. John, you and I do as many of the festivals as we can. And to me, the Sundance Film Festival eats every other festival's lunch when it comes to this. The representation is so much more close to 50-50, not just in competition, but throughout that festival. But perhaps it says something about the difference that is partially on the festivals and partially on Hollywood, because Toronto is a bigger scale Hollywood festival that has many studio movies, films like Halloween and The Predator that would not play at Sundance or Cannes. And the fact that there are fewer female directors means, as we know, there is so much more room to grow when it comes to detecting those incredibly talented first or second time or third time female filmmakers and giving them the shot that they deserve.
We've talked about some movies and performances that were good. Was there any film that kind of landed with more of a thud than a bang in Toronto?
There's a film called Life Itself with Oscar Isaac and many other talented actors. It's written and directed by Dan Fogelman, who does the very twisty This Is Us on NBC. This one had a few twists too many for people. And then I think there's just some movies that, if they didn't land with a thud, they landed with no noise whatsoever. And that might even be worse, John. You know, the opening night film is called Outlaw King. It's with Chris Pine. It's directed by David McKenzie, who directed him in Hell or High Water, a Best Picture nominee. The fact that he would decide to make his next movie with Chris Pine for Netflix, I think, is an indication of how much the landscape is changing. But the fact that that movie wasn't particularly remarkable is also an indication of how Netflix, while it's had more word-of-mouth hits this year than it ever has before when it comes to movies, still could be exacting a little bit better of a ratio when it comes to quality control there. They haven't quite had the same roster of movie hits that they have with TV hits.
Kyle Buchanan is the brand spanking new carpetbagger columnist at the New York Times. He's at the Toronto International Film Festival. Kyle, congrats and thanks for coming back on the show.
Thank you, John.
Coming up, Aaron Dessner from The National and Justin Vernon from Bon Iver have some new music and a new way to listen.
KPCC podcasts are supported by UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting political pundit and cultural raconteur Fran Lebowitz in conversation with Matt Holzman, Sunday, September 30th at 7 p.m. at the Theater at Ace Hotel. A sharp-tongued social critic and keen observer of the irony of human behavior, Lebowitz is often described as a modern-day Dorothy Parker and is known for her sarcasm, wit, and outrageous positions on current affairs and contemporary culture. Tickets at cap.ucla.edu.
And now a new streaming platform recalls the days when music fans traded bootleg tapes and demo recordings. It's called People, and it was developed by Bon Iver's Justin Vernon, brothers Aaron and Bryce Deissner of the band The National, and a couple of German entrepreneurs. People grew out of an artist residency in Berlin, where musicians were given the freedom to collaborate, improvise, and grow. Then, the Deissners and Vernon saw the opportunity to translate that experience into a streaming platform. On People, musicians can collaborate globally and publish completed recordings, as well as works in progress. Aaron Dessner and Vernon also have a new album out called Big Red Machine. Its origins can be traced back to a 2008 AIDS benefit album called Dark Was the Night. When I spoke with Dessner, I asked about how making that charity album led to the music of Big Red Machine.
The idea was to bring in a big community of artists to donate songs to it. And we were trying to write as many new songs as collaboratively or new recordings for that project. And so I, like a lot of people, was in love with Justin's first record. It had just come out for Emma forever ago. And that was 2008. And I wrote him on MySpace, actually.
What was MySpace?
Yeah, I know. And Justin wrote back very enthusiastically and excited to contribute. And so, and one idea was like, well, let's just see if maybe we could write a song. So I recorded some music. The piano part that you just heard, but I had the microphone on the floor. It was before I had a recording studio. And I was maybe 10 feet from the piano, and it was on this wood floor in this house that I lived in Brooklyn. And I called it, you have to name the Pro Tools session, so I called it Big Red Machine because it was on my mind. It was sort of, my brother and I were born in Cincinnati, Ohio in 1976, the year the Cincinnati Reds beat the New York Yankees, and it was just always there in the background. So I just called it Big Red Machine. And Justin, 2 weeks after that, I had sent him the song in an email, and he sent it back having fully written that song to it, to the music, and he kind of interpreted Big Red Machine to mean a heart.
Let's listen to a song from the record. This song is called Forest Green. I was gonna be a storm in water. I want to ask you more about the songwriting process for this album. Everybody who you probably work with is busy and they have their gigs. They're here, they're there, they're everywhere. How do you all come together in one place creatively, even if you're dispersed across the globe? How do you join forces, so to speak?
The main reason that we do these gatherings, I don't like to call them festivals because I think of them as slightly more residency oriented, is to sort of address that issue of how do you bring people together and have the opportunity to plant new creative seeds and grow as an artist and really work together. So we've sort of, like, the Nationals toured for almost 20 years, and we've played music festivals all around the world, including all the big ones. And they aren't really typically places where you have creative, you know, growth or experimentation or an opportunity to do something different. They're really kind of like your highly pressurized commercial situations where, like Coachella, you get up and you have an hour and there's a giant audience and there's like a bunch of other things happening at the same time, and it's kind of like a bit of a popularity contest, as opposed to, you know, trying to actually create a situation where people can come spend some time together and work on something new. And that's kind of what we think about a lot and why we've created this sort of collective that we're working on.
I want to talk a little bit about your work as a producer and how it mirrors what you're doing with people. This is a new track called Swan. It features the singer-songwriter Lisa Hannigan with lyrics by Edna Walsh. You've worked with Lisa Hannigan before. You produced her most recent album, At Swim. Could you tell me a little bit about Swan and how you guys worked together and how you ended up collaborating on this?
So Lisa, I sent her that music, Swan, which I'd written the piano and recorded, sort of produced this song without words, and then sent it to her. And she loved it and started to sketch melodies, but wasn't finding her way lyrically. And she shared it with Enda Walsh, the Irish playwright who collaborated on David Bowie's Black Star, and he's an amazing poet and playwright. And he wrote a text for the song, and then she set it to the song and recorded it and sent it back to me, and I mixed it with my friend John, and then I published it straight up to people, you know. And that's kind of the process. That's how you could imagine things working. And we didn't have to say, well, what's this for, what's the timeline, what's the band name, what's the, you know, promotional commercial goal. We just felt like doing it.
Owing to technology today, it's easily possible for an artist to record an entire album, record pretty much every track for every instrument in his or her own studio or bedroom or wherever, and never really sit down with other musicians, go to a studio, have players come in. And I'm wondering if part of what you're doing with people and this collaborative idea is essentially get people out of their own homes and work with other artists, because it's so easy not to have to leave your own place right now.
Yeah, it's wonderful how democratic it's become with digital software and how you can, you know, anyone can make a high quality recording. You don't need a fancy studio or a lot of money to rent a, you know, space where you can record. But it does take a lot of the alchemy out of music and the kind of spontaneity that comes from interacting and having a conversation through music. And a lot, you know, I grew up collecting Grateful Dead bootlegs and listening to my dad's jazz recordings, and that was pre-internet and pre-streaming economy, our first records that we made on tape. There's something about, like, it's amazing what you can do in your bedroom alone, and like the myth of the solitary auteur genius. I don't know, like, the only auteur geniuses I know are actually really engage with a large community. It's sort of a myth that they're like that. They kind of gather a lot of material and then they're brilliant at editing it. And so, yeah, we're kind of interested in being okay with publishing works in progress or fragments, you know, or developing new material with other people you just have met. And I've found as a musician, that's when I really grow.
We're talking with Aaron Dessner. He's the co-founder of the new music collective People. His new album with Justin Vernon is called Big Red Machine. I want to go back to this idea that you listened to a lot of Grateful Dead bootlegs growing up. And the Dead at a time was really open to that. They would let people plug into their soundboard and get good audio recordings. And also, it was a way that people who followed the band could share what they liked. How do you replicate that model where people can recommend something that's personal to them that bypasses the streaming service computer model of what the computer thinks you should like?
Yeah, I think that's very key. We've sort of lost that sense of discovery. And the algorithm, why can't I like a folk song and some, you know, experimental noise? Why do I only have to listen to folk songs that are similar to the folk song I just heard? The other thing is, like, with database functionality and how easy it is to attach an endlessly scalable amount of metadata to a piece of content you're publishing, why are so many of the experiences that we have in applications so two-dimensional? You can't see who's playing which instrument. And, you know, that's how I used to be endlessly fascinated with music and collecting music, was to really dive into that experience, read the weird essay on the back, figure out that that drummer is playing on another recording you love, or that Jerry Garcia seems to be everywhere in 1967 in San Francisco, or whatever it is. And I think we're trying to recreate some of that because it's easy to do. So if you look at Big Red Machine on the People platform, and you say show credits, you can see everybody on every track, which is, you know, there's up to 30 musicians on the whole record. And then you can link to anything that they've done. And it's sort of blockchain, like everyone remains linked to everything they do. And over time, if you think about a musician's whole career, over 20, 30 years, 40 years, that could become a really interesting sort of web.
I have a last question. I'll admit that when I was listening to some of your music today, I used Spotify, so 1/16th of 1 cent is coming your way. But in an ideal world, how do listeners and musicians use People in some sort of relationship with streaming services like Spotify or Apple Music? Is there any way that they can coexist, or do they have to be separate because they have such different business models?
Now, I really see it as a symbiotic relationship, where what we've built, the platform we've built, is really for a lot of the music that will live there is probably not the kind of music or not intended to go wide and to go out to, you know, the more these giant databases like Spotify or Apple. But things that do, like Big Red Machine is an album that, you know, we want people all over the world, where however they're listening, to be able to hear it. So in that sense, the People platform becomes more like an aggregator, and it actually publishes out, you know, to those other streaming services. And that's really the artist's choice entirely. And it's also, again, it's an experiment, so we don't totally know where it will lead. And I think that's part of the fun of it.
Aaron Dessner is a member of The National. He's also the co-founder of the new music collective People. His new album with Justin Vernon is called Big Red Machine. Aaron, great talking to you. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Holy torch, my perdition. Big Red Machine is available on streaming services, including People.com. But note, there's a dash in between each of the letters of People. Otherwise, you'll go to the website of a certain celebrity magazine. Coming up, a look at how Hollywood has historically portrayed FBI agents on screen.
KBCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's Science Fair, the number one audience award winner at Sundance and South by Southwest. Hailed by critics as inspirational and invigorating and supremely entertaining, the documentary follows nine high school students from around the globe as they navigate rivalries, setbacks, and hormones on their journey to change the world through science. Visit sciencefairfilm.com for more information. Science Fair, in theaters starting September 21st.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The FBI has been in the news since the firing of Agent Peter Strzok, who was caught trash texting then-candidate Donald Trump during the 2016 presidential campaign. It's the latest episode in the long, complicated history of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and there's an interesting parallel history in how the FBI has been portrayed in fictional movies and TV series. The Frame contributor Tim Grieving has the scoop.
The FBI started out strong, at least in terms of the movies. They were there to collar big-time criminals, especially the mafia and gangsters like Johnny Dillinger. Here's the trailer for The FBI Story, a 1959 film starring Jimmy Stewart.
This is the official shield of the FBI. Now, for the first time, you'll see the real, the authentic, the fascinating inside story of the FBI.
When I got there, the FBI, you know, to impress new employees, were still telling us all about that FBI story with Jimmy Stewart, even though it was like 20 years old by that time.
That's Chris Lynch, who joined the FBI as a clerk in 1976 and wound up working in counterintelligence during the height of the Cold War before moving over to the CIA. He wrote about his experiences in the book The CI Desk.
And there was a TV show with Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. about the FBI.
The bear in the corner by the ladder.
They don't match our subject's description, but one is definitely armed.
Right, Don.
That had been off the air for a few years, but they were still very proud of it and talking about it when I was a new employee there.
But when Lynch watches a movie or show about the FBI, he can't help but notice the inaccuracies.
Well, generally, you see those in comedies. Comedies depend very heavily on tropes about the FBI that are really pretty much off base. I mean, they may have a nugget of accuracy, but FBI agents are always tall white males. They're humorless, officious, pompous. They're stuffed shirts who are given to say things like, "This is a matter of national security." Ooh.
Lynch says a few movies have gotten it mostly right over the years.
They're not necessarily flattering to the FBI, but they're very human and in some ways reflected how the FBI worked. The Informant with Matt Damon showed a white-collar criminal case that was being developed stage by stage and actually became a cautionary tale of the problems of depending very heavily on this one source who turned out to be nuts.
Who else did you tell about the raid?
Well, I had to tell my secretary. Guys, I'm the head of the bioproducts division. You know, she has to know where to get in touch with me. I told her months ago. So all I said was, "Liz, I'm doing some work with the FBI. I might be out of touch for a while."
An American Hustle with Bradley Cooper. I like the interaction between the street agent and the supervisor and how he maneuvered to get things taken care of that, violating procedures sometimes, but it showed how they developed the case, his vanity, and often he was in over his head and he didn't really think things through.
I'm thinking big. All right, this is going to be fantastic. We're doing video surveillance. I'm doing this from the feet up.
You will never do it properly because you got too much government attitude to be small and sleek. I'm like the Viet Cong, man, all right? I'm in and I'm out. I was there the whole time. You don't know it.
Accurate portrayals matter to the FBI, says Betsy Glick from the Bureau's Public Affairs Division.
The reason we care about how people perceive the FBI
is because we need the public to help us solve cases. And if they're getting wrong information, they may not be willing to help an agent when he knocks on their door. So the bottom line is, if screen portrayals give viewers an inaccurate picture of the FBI, whether it's illegal torture, unauthorized wiretapping, abuse of power, or ethics, might affect their decision to help us.
Which is why the Bureau lends a hand to Hollywood whenever anyone reaches out to them.
Most of what we do is reactive. It's writers calling us and asking us for information while they're writing the script. Does this sound authentic? Would an agent say this? Those kinds of things that lend authenticity. It's not about making everything rainbows and unicorns. It's really trying to show people the real FBI in hopes that A, they're going to help us when we need it, or B, maybe they're going to be inspired to take a career. That's why we work with Hollywood.
As for Chris Lynch, he put his own spin on how the FBI is portrayed when he was a consultant on the FX series The Americans.
What do you do, Stan?
I'm an FBI agent.
FBI? Wow, what do you catch, bank robbers and stuff?
Actually, I work in counterintelligence now.
That's against spies, right?
Exactly.
Joe Weisberg, who created the show and is the showrunner, read my book. At one time, I described this electronic mail cart that ran up and down the halls of the intelligence division at one point and got on everybody's nerves because it did the job about one-tenth of the value of actually humans. But this attracted his attention, and he created the mail robot from that. And it's become a popular character, even has its own T-shirt.
What does it do?
It delivers mail.
And he started asking me other questions about the FBI, just mainly atmospherics, on how the office looked and secretarial pay scales and nameplates and all sorts of things like that.
And the relationship between Hollywood and the FBI goes both ways. Tomorrow, we'll hear how certain FBI agents on screen have inspired some to become agents in real life.
I actually had the opportunity to work with a young female agent recently who said, the reason I'm here is that I was motivated to apply to be an FBI agent because of Jodie Foster's character in The Silence of the Lambs.
For The Frame, for now, I'm Tim Grieving.
And that is it for today. If you missed any part of the show, you can subscribe to The Frame as a podcast. You'll find it on iTunes and Spotify. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.